It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about the cutthroat world of barbecue competitions.
First, former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold announced this morning that he's running for Senate in 2016. His announcement sets the stage for a likely rematch of his 2010 race with Senator Ron Johnson, who ultimately won that seat.
Feingold shared the news in a video speaking at his home in Middleton. Let's give a listen to that now.
People tell me all the time that our politics in Washington are broken, and that multimillionaires, billionaires, and big corporations are calling all the shots. They especially say this about the U.S. Senate, and it's hard not to agree. But what are we going to do? Get rid of the Senate? Actually, no one I've listened to says we should throw in the towel and give up. And I don't think that either. Instead, let's fight together for change. That means helping to bring back to the U.S. Senate strong independence, bipartisanship, and honesty. So, today, I'm pleased to announce that I'm planning to run for the United States Senate in 2016.
The voice of Russ Feingold there. Joining us now to talk about that 2016 Senate race is Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
Well, so the news out there right now that Russ Feingold going to run for his seat again in 2016. He lost to Ron Johnson in 2010. Was this a surprise to anyone?
Well, I don't think so. When Feingold left the government service, the State Department service, in February, I believe it was, he said he would be going around the state and listening to people. And I think it had been rumored that he would make a announcement sometime in the spring. So today is maybe not the date that we were expecting, but certainly it's the right season when we've been led to think he probably would announce.
We're a year and a half away from that 2016 election. Governor Scott Walker has not even announced that he's running for president. So is this early for an announcement like this for the Senate?
Well, it does seem like it is part of the chain of moving elections earlier and earlier. If we go back to 2010, Ron Johnson didn't enter the race until May, or maybe it was even the 1st of June. Up until April in 2010, former Governor Thompson was actually talking about running. So if, by that standard of 6 years ago, this is very early to start a campaign. But you look at the presidential race, you look at Governor Walker and the activities of all the other potential and declared candidates, and I think we have moved elections up fully into the year before the election instead of waiting until the spring of the election year.
Now, Senator Ron Johnson has been asked about what he thinks about a potential Russ Feingold entering the race, and he hasn't said, oh, and by the way, I'm not running. He seems to be in it. But do we definitely know that he's going to run in 2016?
Well, he hasn't declared, as far as I know, but he certainly has given every indication of running. It would be, I think, at this point, a very big surprise if he changed his mind and decided not to run.
Looking back at that 2010 matchup between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, what happened?
Well, there are several things that were going on. One that I think does have to be recognized is the huge wave election of 2010 that swept Republicans into office at all levels, governors, senators, members of the House of Representatives, and legislators. 2010 was a exceptionally good year for Republicans all over. But it also is fair to say that during that time, candidate Ron Johnson developed a fairly positive image with voters. And Senator Feingold at the time was seen as not as likely to create jobs in the country during that campaign, and less able to bring about change in the Senate. So I think there were particular aspects of the race that had to do with the two candidates, Johnson and Feingold, and their records and backgrounds, but it was also in the context of an election year in which Republicans were advantaged nationwide.
Feingold has been doing various things in time between that loss, and now he's been a law professor, he's been an envoy in Africa. Why is he picked now to try to get back in it, or rather 2016?
Well, aside from the fact that it's a rematch with Senator Johnson a chance to have that do-over, if you will. The previous Senate race in 2012 involved Tammy Baldwin and was rather quickly followed rather quickly on the heels of the 2010 defeat. So I expect a little more time between the races as part of this. But Senator Johnson remains surprisingly well-known in the state, given that he has been out of office for going on 5 years now and out of the state for most of that time. In our April poll, we found that just 26% said they didn't know enough about him to have an opinion of him. In contrast, Senator Johnson, 39% said they didn't have an opinion about him. So despite being out of office, Senator Feingold remains a bit better known than our current senior senator, Senator Johnson.
We're talking right now with Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. We've been previewing next year's Senate race. Today, former Senator Russ Feingold announced his campaign in 2016. Looks like a matchup between Senator Ron Johnson and former Senator Russ Feingold. And you were starting to get into the polls there, and I know that you've done some polling on a potential matchup. What have you found?
Well, in April, we polled the state, and this is among registered voters statewide. And at that point, 54% preferred Feingold, 38% for Johnson, 9% undecided. We have to hasten to say how early this is. This is a first impression. If you will, this is where the two have lined up at the starting line with Feingold a bit ahead. But how they run the race and who finishes first across the finish line is the critical thing, and we have a very long ways to go. But I think that 54-38 number suggests that Feingold enters with a considerable amount of support and goodwill in the state.
So is Ron Johnson considered vulnerable at this point based on numbers like that?
Well, I think he's considered vulnerable partly from that, partly from the 39% that can't rate him. Of those who could, though, 32 have a favorable view, 29 an unfavorable view of Ron Johnson. So he's not a lot above water, not a lot net positive, but he is some. Feingold's much better, though, at 47-26, so a very high plus 21 net favorable. But before the Feingold forces celebrate that too much, it's worth remembering that when Tommy Thompson entered the Senate race in January of 2012, he had a 49-31 net favorable, almost as strong, and yet fell off to 37-51 by the election and, of course, lost to Tammy Baldwin. So that's another way of saying that both Thompson and Feingold come into their races as longtime office holders with lots of goodwill. But the Thompson example is a warning that that early goodwill can be lost over the course of the campaign.
Now, based on that campaign announcement video that we heard and his past track record, Feingold's big platform seems to be getting big money out of politics, campaign finance reform. So the question becomes, how do you beat the drum for those causes and still raise money for your campaign?
Well, this has been an issue for him before, and in the new money world of the post-Citizens United decisions that has really opened the floodgates for independent expenditures, this will be a challenge for Feingold. How does he adapt to the modern world of campaign finance without handicapping himself by refusing supporters' money, or on the other hand, without a large flip-flop on the issue of money? That's an issue that remains to be seen. Also, in his opening statements in that video, he emphasized a more populist notion that the country has got too much influence from millionaires and billionaires. So it will also be interesting how he plays the populism card going forward into the campaign.
And on the other hand, Ron Johnson apparently has said that, unlike last time, he is not going to put his own money up for 2016's campaign. What do you make of that and the effect that could have?
Well, Senator Johnson has been raising a good bit of money. I think in the last quarterly report from the Federal Election Commission, he had his best fundraising quarter ever. So he's certainly running a more conventional campaign in which donors drive the campaign rather than self-financing. That's not unusual for a second-term senator, even if they self-finance the first. There are a few that have continued to self-finance, but most move to the more normal fundraising and campaign contributors.
Charles, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. We've been looking at next year's Senate race after former Senator Russ Feingold's campaign announcement this morning.
Grilling season is heating up and barbecue competitions are popping up around the state. This month is National Barbecue Month, and this weekend the town of Sauk City is hosting the Madison Magazine Barbecue Festival.
With names like A Fine Swine, Crash Test Smokers, and a boy named Q, teams of barbecue enthusiasts come from all over the country to put their secret recipes to the test, competing for trophies, prize money, and pride.
Joining us here in the studio now is Wes Ray. He's the head cook for Wanacue Barbecue. That's a competitive barbecue team based in Wanakee. Wes, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rob, Veronica.
Well, we've got a lot of sampling here, but I want to talk about some basics first. How did you get started doing barbecue competitions, Wes?
Well, I was a driveway cooker for 8 or 9 years. I learned that from my father-in-law. And then some friends who knew that I liked barbecue and that I cooked quite a bit, they told me about TV shows and competitions around the state. So eventually I decided to head up to Warren's for a competition there, and then to Princeton for a competition there, and I just met great people, and I thought, this is something that'll be a lot of fun to get into.
Now, walk me through a typical day of barbecue competition. What happens?
So, generally, the teams will roll in, say, mid-morning on Friday for a Saturday competition. We'll get our cooker in place. They'll show us where our cook site is. We'll get our cooker in place, set up our canopy, the tables, and all the required equipment. And then you want to get your meat inspection completed right away so you can begin seasoning. Because you can trim things at home, but you cannot do any seasoning. So the meat inspection makes sure that you're using only the allowable cuts and no seasoning ahead of time. And after you get your seasoning started, based on your own schedule, I'm not going to share that with you today, but you spend some time walking around, meeting people you haven't seen in a while, making some new friends. Then it's really wide open. About 5 o'clock, you'll have a mandatory cooks meeting. And after that, it's just you put the gas down and go.
Now, this is in Wisconsin. There are places that are thought of as barbecue capitals, I think, of Kansas City and that region. Is Wisconsin, does it have a thriving barbecue competition scene?
You know, Wisconsin barbecue is really growing a lot. We have more than a dozen competitions here in the state this year, I believe. I've already done one, did one in Appleton a couple weeks ago. We're doing Sauk City this week. I know there's one in Oconomowoc. I'm doing the one just outside of Lambeau Field in mid-July.
There's a lot going on.
There's one in Grafton, Kenosha, Washington Island, Death's Door Barbecue Competition. They're really all over. Manitowoc, I could keep listing them, but I won't take the time.
Well, and I imagine the question a lot of people have is, how do I become a judge for one of these? Mm-hmm. I assume there's a lot of competition there. But what does a judge do? How does the judging work?
So these competitions are sanctioned by the Kansas City Barbecue Society, or KCBS. And so what I did, because judging really helps you prepare to compete. So I took the barbecue judging class. I did it at Fox Valley Technical College. Chef Jeff, who runs the Chef's Gone Grillin' team, he teaches that class along with some other folks. So you take a class, and you learn to judge based on appearance, taste, and tenderness. Those are the three things that a judge will review for each of the meat categories. And the four meat categories we have in KCBS competitions are chicken, pork ribs, pork shoulder, and beef brisket.
Well, I'm looking at a plate with all four of those on it right now. Thank you for bringing that in. I'm not going to try to get any trade secrets from you here, but I'm going to taste it, and I want you to tell me a little bit about what goes into a good competitive grill here. So I'm going to start with the chicken. I got a chicken thigh here, and just start talking about it while I nibble here, okay?
Sure. So in general, chicken, there are two pieces of the chicken most teams
will... Blue ribbon. I already made my decision.
Most teams will cook. It's either the thigh or the drumstick. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of a move toward drumsticks, but thighs are still kind of top-notch. And so you want to... Chicken is very tender. It doesn't want to take very much smoke. So you really manage the smoke carefully. A big part of the chicken is having bite-through skin, which you are, of course, experiencing there. Because the judge doesn't want to take a bite, pull away, and have the rest of that skin slap him in the chin or her in the chin. So bite-through skin, don't over-smoke it, and don't forget to let them taste the meat. Lots of people
don't cover up the meat.
Yeah, you have to have the right combination of smoke, seasonings, and meat.
Talking to Wes Ray. He's with the Wanacue Barbecue Team, head cook there. It's we're talking about competitive barbecue right now. Now, barbecue, does this always involve sauced or are there dry rubs? Do people do that too?
Well, so on appearance, taste, and tenderness, sauce is a big part of the appearance score. It doesn't have to be, but it ends up being, because that sauce gives it, it looks fresh and shiny and moist, and then it also contributes to that mouth feel. How does that bite feel in your mouth? And so the sauce really is a contributor. Me personally, if I'm just making barbecue for myself, I'm a dry rub guy.
Really?
On the ribs, I'm dry rub. But when I'm competing, we finish it with a good glaze. You don't want to over-sauce it, but you want the right amount of sauce right in there.
Well, you've got enough sauce on things. I think I can't touch anything in the studio now. What should I move on to next? That was the chicken.
So if you're going to go in competition order, you move on to the pork spare ribs.
Pork spare ribs here. Okay. So I'm going to try this now and talk me through it.
Right. So one of the keys, if you want to take a bite from the middle, so one of the key things people think, oh, that's not tender. That's not a fall-off-the-bone rib. Mm-hmm. Well, fall-off-the-bone rib is just restaurant speak. It's easy to have fall-off-the-bone ribs because anybody can overcook them. What you want to have when the judge bites your rib is a very easy pull, and the only part of the meat that comes off that bone is the crescent shape where you took the bite, which is what you got. And so if it falls off the bone, you're going to be judged down. You'll be graded down.
They'll call that overcooked.
Yeah, it'll be overcooked. So again, you want to taste sweet, meat, and heat. That's kind of a good combination in that order, and that the sauce kind of helps with that. And in barbecue, you have layers of flavor, and so you want to have that sweet right off the top, and then the meat as you chew through it, and a little bit of heat as you swallow.
That's exactly what I'm getting. It's kind of smoky. Now, is that just literally from the smoke? And I talked to you earlier. This is charcoal and wood.
Yes. So
no gas allowed.
No. So for competitions, you can only cook charcoal or wood or a combination of those. No gas, no electricity allowed. That's another thing. When they're doing the meat inspection, they'll also review your cooking. Your cooker, as the case is, and make sure you don't have any of that hooked up.
Now, before we get to the next item on the menu, are you competing here for the money mainly, for the trophy, or is this mostly about the pride?
It's really about the fun and the pride. You really want to do well, just so you can talk about it with your friends and the other teams. It's a competitive activity for sure. Everybody's going for the top points and the top prize, but it's really friendly. So it's very competitive, but I would not call it cutthroat.
So there aren't spies trying to figure out what your spice mix is, what's going in your sauce?
Well,
you don't have the Bill Belichick on the other team trying to read your signals.
You're right. Nobody mixes their stuff at the cook site. You do that at home.
Oh, really? Okay. Right. So you do keep it secret.
Yeah, you bring it in. You don't season the meat, but my rubs are mixed, my cooks are mixed, my sop or spray is all mixed and ready to use.
Okay, now am I moving on to the pulled pork next?
Pulled pork would be the third category.
I like pulled pork a lot. I mean, I crock pot a lot. How do you do pulled pork well on a grill?
Well, it starts out, of course, it's rubbed, and it starts out just naked, not wrapped up or anything, and it's important. So the chicken and the ribs are much more on a schedule, combination of temperature and schedule. But the big meats, the pork shoulder and the brisket, are a lot based on how they feel at various stages of the cook, what their temperatures are, because you don't want to oversmoke the meat. The pores of the meat will close up at about 160 degrees, and if you just keep smoking it after that, the smoke will pile up on top and you'll get a very bitter, some people call it a lighter fluid taste. So
okay.
You have to be careful. If you're not going to wrap it up, you have to be sure you have a clean, low smoke or no smoke burn at that point in the cook, or you cover it up.
Okay, that is awesome too. Everything really good so far. The smart money's on Wanacue, I think, in this competition. Let's get the beef brisket in. Key to a good grilled beef brisket.
So, like I said, you don't want to oversmoke it. Mm-hmm. And in barbecue competition, you'll use a whole brisket, not just the flat, but both muscles, the point and the flat, they're still connected. And so the burnt ends, they're not really burnt, of course, but they have a lot more char, more bark to them. That's cubed up from the point, the underneath and big bulbous side part of the muscle on the backside. And then the slices on the plate are from the flat. So you want to turn both flat slices and point burnt ends into the judges so they understand, they know you understand what the muscles are and how to treat them.
Now, on the competition side of this, as you go around the state to these different competitions, are there teams that are known as the teams to beat in this state?
Absolutely.
Who are they?
So one of the host hometown teams there, A Fine Swine.
That's in Sauk City.
Yes, in Sauk City. David and his family, he has a really great team. Out of Oshkosh, a team called Tim's Full Belly Deli. Also the Fox Valley Barbecue. Fox River Barbecue, they're really very good. A team called Bringing the Heat out of Montello, Chefs Gone Grillin' out of Fox Valley area, very good teams.
Well, Wes, thank you so much for coming up today and sharing the samples, and good luck at your competitions this summer.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Wes Ray. He's head cook for Wanakee Barbecue, like Wanakee Barbecue. They're a competitive barbecue team based in Wanakee.
The word spinster didn't always have an unflattering meaning attached to it. It began as an honorable reference to unmarried women who spun thread for a living in 15th century Europe.
Our next guest is out to restore the word spinster. In her world, the word means leading a passionately lived, fully intentional life as a single woman.
Kate Bullock joins us now. She's a contributing editor to The Atlantic and the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Kate, how would you describe what the word spinster means to you and how it evolved over the years for you?
To me, the spinster has always been an image of self-reliance and autonomy and even a kind of glamorous inscrutability. We don't know what the spinster is up to behind the closed doors of her home. And so she's free to be whoever she likes. And I don't know where I got that idea, but that's how I've always thought of her, of the spinster.
Well, your book grew out of a magazine article on being a single woman, and that really struck a nerve for a lot of people. And you found out while you were researching that you were really part of a growing demographic of women who choose not to marry and not to be in a formal partnership. How big a trend is that today?
Well, I would say it's not necessarily that women are choosing not to marry or rejecting marriage outright, although, of course, many women do, but it's more about how women are pushing marriage off and getting married later and have a more ambivalent relationship to the idea of marriage and don't necessarily organize their lives around it the way we have in the past.
So spinster to you is not something that you choose and you sort of brand yourself with it and that's you for the rest of your life. It's sort of the best choice for now.
I mean, that's one way of putting it. I would say that what I'm trying to get at in the book is that there is no one right way of doing things and that our romantic and domestic arrangements are all highly personal, individualized, and have been different at different points in history. People have always been questioning them and rearranging them. So we tend to think that there has been one right way or that marriage has always been the one and only way. And so not only is that not true, but I want people to walk away from the book just being aware of the variety of possibilities and that one needn't swear themselves to one way of being, that they're, you know, one could be single for 5 years and then get married or single for 15 years and get married or be married for 20 years and then become single.
Do we know what's driving the demographic of women choosing to put off marriage?
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, it's without a doubt the gains of the second wave of the women's movement. So all of the battles that were fought then have been, you know, the women of my generation and, you know, a couple of generations before me have been living out those gains. And we are, you know, pursuing careers and educations in higher numbers than ever before. So this has been going on for quite a while, but now the numbers have finally swelled to such a degree that it's a much more visible shift than it was. So it's been taking place, but sort of invisibly. And now that we have more than, you know, half of women are unmarried, it's just undeniable. We can't sideline the single experience the way that we once could.
And you write that early on, women are raised their whole lives, intentionally maybe or not, with two questions at the back of their mind, always sometimes at the front of their mind. Who am I going to marry and when am I going to marry them? What do you think is the consequence of growing up with those two questions always being present somehow?
I think that it over-prioritizes the importance of romantic love and then makes a person feel like a failure if they don't find it at a certain time. I think that a lot of a woman's self-worth can be erroneously invested in whether or not she's found someone. And it also sort of takes the light off of more or equal. I'm not denying the importance of love. I think love is a very important thing in a person's life, but also one's talents and ambitions and other, you know, skills and strengths. These are all just as important. And instead, we tend to be, you know, society is telling young girls that marriage is the most important thing, not these other things. Even though at the same time, in schools, we're, you know, trying to empower girls to pursue their own strengths and so forth.
And when your mother died, you, it sounds like, realized that those questions were not exactly how you wanted to frame your life anymore. How did you shift the way you started thinking about yourself and the path that lay ahead?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're bringing up that part of the book because, you know, I didn't realize that my mother and her death would be part of the book until I started writing it. And I was kind of dismayed because I wanted this to be a book of my 30s. I wanted it to be an adult book. And to realize that I had to start at the age of 23 when she died, because that's really when I started becoming an adult, and that in her death really absolutely shaped the way that I approached my adulthood. And that was with the feeling of, you know, she had been sort of a late bloomer. She had put her own ambitions to be a writer aside in order to raise my brother and me. I don't think she was at all tormented by her choices. She loved being a mother. She loved my father. But I felt and, you know, witnessed her frustration around work when she finally did start pursuing her writing ambitions in her late 30s. And then she, you know, sort of right as she was coming into her own and feeling the full measure of her powers, she got breast cancer and died at 52. And it was, you know, traumatized. I mean, you know, it was a terrible time. It was terrible to lose her. But it also made me feel so deeply how short life is, and that there isn't time to be making compromises, and that I knew that I wanted to try to become a writer, and that that would take a lot of work, and that that's the star I wanted to guide myself by. Sorry, go on.
And having lost your mother, you were pretty young still at that point, it sounds like you looked for women who could have those meaningful conversations about how to direct your life, and you found them, and you found them in other writers. They weren't present in your life except for through their writing. You call them awakers. Who were they?
Yeah, so they were Maeve Brennan, a mid-century essayist for The New Yorker, Neith Boyce, who was a journalist and novelist at the turn of the last century, who wrote a column for Vogue called The Bachelor Girl in the year 1898 about her decision to never marry, Edith Wharton, who became the famous grande dame and novelist we know her as only after she left her husband in her 40s and she lived alone for the rest of her life, Edna St. Vincent Millay, who in the early 1900s was America's most famous and iconic single woman before she ended up marrying and having an open marriage, and then Charlotte Perkins Gilman, the feminist writer and activist, also from the turn of the last century.
And what did you learn from exploring these women's lives and their choices?
Well, you know, I'd say, you know, I call them my awakeners, which is a term I borrowed from Edith Wharton, who used it in her memoir to describe the books and people who had guided her intellectual journey. And what these women did for me is I just found them in the course of my own reading. I would happen upon them, or a new biography would come out, and I would start these conversations with them in my head, and then I would start going in deeper. I'd go past the biography and find their letters and diaries or people who knew them and really start learning about their lives. And they each taught me very different things that were all so highly, you know, personal or idiosyncratic, you know, what I took away from them. But what they all had in common was a very deliberate approach to their own lives, that they questioned their own motivations each step of the way, lived with great intention. And that's what I found ultimately most useful about from between all of them. That's what they were all very different women, but what they all had in common was great intentionality and deliberation, that they didn't take anything for granted or follow convention for the sake of it, but paused and thought about what was best for them, even if that meant reversing course and making a decision and deciding it was the wrong decision. You know, in the case of Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was born in 1860, she decided as a teenager, I'm never marrying. I want to change the world. I've got lots of things to do. I don't have time to get married. But then in her early 20s, fell in love with a man, and the only way to have sex during that time, in a non-scandalous way, was to be married. And so after 2 years of pushing him off, she finally succumbed to marriage and was in love with him, but was feeling physical desires, and then ended up getting pregnant and falling into America's most famous postpartum depression, which she immortalized in her story, The Yellow Wallpaper. And she decided after that, this just isn't for me. I'm not supposed to be married. And so her husband married her best friend, and she and her husband shared custody of her daughter. This was totally unheard of at this time in the late 1800s. And she was a public figure. People were so angry at her for doing this. She received a lot of censure. But, what she did was spend the next 10 years of her life traveling around the country, calling herself a woman at large, was her self-designation, lecturing on topics about how to change and improve women's lives. So, I see her as very inspiring in that sense, that she knew what she wanted. She made a mistake. She corrected for the mistake.
It's interesting that you went back to these five women of earlier generations for kind of your role models and your guides. Do you think there are contemporary role models and guides? I'm thinking of Carrie Bradshaw, Sex and the City, or Ally McBeal, and they don't seem to have the same substance.
Right. I think that, we're still in a moment that is not offering a lot of examples for how to be a single woman, and that the examples that are on offer are very narrow, urban, professional, kind of dating obsessed. I mean, I like both of those shows as shows, but I don't blame them for not. It's not the fault of the shows that we don't have enough varieties on offer. There just need to be more. So that's why I was feeling that paucity of options when I was, in my late 20s and early 30s, and looking back, and I knew that I would find guides and role models during the second wave of the women's movement. There was an enormous public critique of marriage and conversation going on then, but I hadn't known about this same conversation going on at the turn of the last century. And so just finding it was very exciting and fresh to me. And the ways in which women were talking about their lives then was very personal and intimate because it was pre-ideological. Today, the conversation is encumbered with a lot of jargon and specific notes that need to be hit. But they were writing at a time before the conversation had been codified, so their voices felt more intimate to me. And then also, of course, the fact that they all lived a long time ago and were writers means that they, there are records of the ways in which they were thinking about these questions that I think about. So there are plenty of women doing that now, but I don't have access to their diaries and email accounts. So I can't be reading the way that they think about it. And so that it was, because these women lived so long ago and so much had been written about them and that they had left records behind, that I was able to create this internal conversation with them.
We're talking right now to Kate Bullock. She's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own.
And we want to hear from you. You can give us some insight into what's going on today. Are you part of this growing demographic of women who choose to be single? What do you like about the single life? Would you choose it all over again? And do you think society is ready to give equal standing to single women? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking now to Kate Bullock. She's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own.
And we want to hear from you. Are you one of the growing number of women who choose to stay single? What do you like about the single life? Would you choose it all over again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our callers now and take a call from Kate in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question for both you and Kate. That I'm young, personally, and I'm married, and I am expecting a child in September. And my question was, you know, I kind of always had this idea in my mind about getting married at a young age and then eventually, you know, having kids before 30. And I guess I was kind of wondering how biology kind of played a role in all of this, because that was just my idea, you know, having kids at 26, you know, and starting the family, because I feel like if I was to do it later, like how she was saying, that maybe it would be too late, you know?
Right. Great question, Kate. Thank you for bringing that up. The biological clock, does that play sort of an imperative role in some of this? Because there are options, as you say, and you want women to know the options they have and to explore them, but there are certain things you can't work around, like how long you can have babies.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's, I happen to be one of the people who never had a strong desire to have children. So that made it easier for me to be more ambivalent about marriage, because I just was ambivalent about starting a family as it was. You know, and then what's also interesting right now about this new day and age in which we live is assisted reproductive technologies and how that's changing the landscape as well. And so, you know, once upon a time, a spinster, the classic definition was an unmarried, childless woman past her prime. And now we, you know, I just wrote an article for Cosmopolitan magazine about the rise of single mothers by choice and women who are choosing to have children on their own. So that's adding a new twist to this whole changing demographic. And yeah, like I sometimes, in a sort of utopian, idealistic way, I wish that we could totally rechange society so that women were having babies at their biological baby-making prime between the ages of 18 and 25. And so we could all have babies then, and then, you know, have college and careers set up, you know, and then our mothers are retiring just in time to be taking care of the children or something, you know. But it's very complicated working this all out. And we still, you know, America is so behind the rest of the Western world in the ways in which we don't support working mothers. So it does make it really hard for women to be figuring out how to map out their lives.
Thank you so much for that call, Kate. Appreciate that. We have an open line at 800-642-1234. And Kate's question reminds me, I read some of the conversation that was started up because of your book, and there were some married women with children who wrote to say, this is so interesting. I'm very thoughtful about this because I feel as though my life is unfolding in a way that maybe I would have thought differently about if I'd read this book first, and I'm going to think about it and watch what happens. You get a lot of response from women who have chosen marriage and children who are thinking differently about their lives.
I do, yeah. I hear from everybody in all kinds of situations, and it's, you know, I write early in the book, I was reading Milan Kundera, and he had some line about women. Oh, I don't know. I was struck by the idea that women seem to often be running away from their lives once they had created them, and that why couldn't we be figuring it out beforehand, or having that time on our own beforehand? Why were we leaving husbands and children behind in order to find that, like at least in novels or something? But yeah, I do hear from lots of women saying that this is, yeah, they wish they could have thought about things a little bit differently. And that is great for me to hear, because what I'm also loving is hearing from young women in their early 20s saying, oh, thanks, this is showing me the possibilities, the range of ways to think that I hadn't thought of before, and which is exactly what I want. And the other thing I want a reader to do is to be thinking about her own awakeners, that the women I write about in the book are the ones who were most useful to me, but just like life itself is a very individuated process of making what it, you know, should be, I think that finding your own awakeners is really useful, and that we each have our own.
Now, other responders to your book said things that were more challenging. They said, you know, sure, she's glamorous now, and she's got a book, and she's beautiful. Wait till she's older. Then it's not going to be such a selling prospect for people to think about. What do you think about that kind of critique?
I find that frustrating and limiting, because it's complicated critique, because, you know, there I am on the cover of this book, you know, a hair stylist and makeup stylist, you know, I've been totally dolled up and look a lot more glamorous than I actually am in my everyday life, right? But also, I'm not choosing, this isn't about rejecting marriage or rejecting love. It's about finding how to balance love and autonomy is what the central conflict of my own adult life has been. So that critique, I think, comes from people who haven't actually read the book.
Well, Kate, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kate Bullock is a contributing editor to The Atlantic, and she's the author of Spinster, Making a Life of One's Own. And we'd love to hear what you have to say about this, about your own life experiences, your own life choices, whether you're a man or a woman. Have you, do you think, fully explored the possibilities and times in your life when you were partnered and unpartnered? And what did you find to be sort of the gifts of both of those times of lives? Call us at 800-642-1234 or at this point, go to our Facebook page. You can leave your comments there.